I just want to quickly recap the key aspects of what we talked about last week, either if you weren't able to listen to the share or you've forgotten, either way. Basically, the core aspect of what we spoke about last week, which is relevant also to this week, is understanding the Persian context of Esther. As I said last week, Megillat Esther, more than any other biblical book, is intentionally and carefully crafted. It is a written with like style and flourish and all those sorts of things in ways probably few other biblical books are done so intently. And the key thing is Megillat Esther really gets Persian life. And the problem is we don't get Persian life. We don't know what it was like to be a Jew in Persia. So sometimes the Megillah is explicitly making references to the experience of Jews in Persia, the experience of Jews in exile. And we kind of, it just goes right over our heads. We fail to notice that because we aren't involved in that context. So what I spent a significant amount of time last week talking about was just kind of setting up these 3 weeks, which is the Persian context. I mentioned that Persia is best to think of without, admittedly, I'm committing the great sin of anachronism. Persia is best thought of as kind of a tolerant society. Again, not by 21st century standards, but in the sense that there was, again, religious freedom, not by 21st century standards, but the idea was you could be a Jew, and as long as basically you paid your, you know, dues to the king, you paid your taxes, you were allowed to do whatever you wanted. This is why it's under Persia. This is why Chazal looks so positively on the Persian kings, because the Persian kings turned around to the Jews and were like, go build your Beit HaMikdash. You can do it. We don't have any qualms with that. And it's also why a lot of Jews turned around and said, no, we're okay staying here, which is something we'll talk about next week. The reason Jews wanted to stay was because life in Persia was generally good. And as I mentioned, there are three famous things Persia is known for that all occur in the Megillah. The first was its legal system. It's kind of its system of courts, the Yodei Dat Vadin. I pointed this out last week. Those who know the law are actually, you know, somewhat significant characters in the Megillah. As we read the Megillah now a couple of weeks from Thursday, you'll see the Yodei Dat Vadin, those who know the law, the rules, they have, you know, they turn up in scenes, and it's because that was normal for Persia. The mail system, the postal system, again, everything. How many times do we read in the Megillah, they sent it out in each and every language, in each and every script. The mail carriers went forth. Persia was famed for its communication. And the third was its tolerance. So again, the fact that all of these edicts, all of these royal edicts go out to every language possible already hints at Persia's willingness to accommodate everyone. But more crucially for us, Jews weren't segregated to a specific role. You could be a Jew and you could happily rise to whatever role you could. Obviously, the end of the Megillah bears this out. The Megillah accepts it's plausible for Mordechai to be second in command, which either sounds like absolute make-believe and they lived happily ever after till the end of their days, or, and this is what is actually happening, the Megillah, that is possible in Persia. If this was a story that took place in Babel, in Babylon, or in Assyria, or in, you know, in 1900s, 1800s Germany, it would not be possible. You would not have a story where, oh, and this person went to be second in command. That's not how things work. But in Persia, it's normal. And even at the beginning of the story, we talked about this last week, Mordechai is described as being Yoshev B'Sha'ar HaMelech, sitting at the king's gate. What that actually means is he works for the Persian bureaucracy. We talked about this at length last week, but that is basically the important thing to realize, that to be a Jew in Persia was relatively good. If there was one period you could go back in time to and live life as a Jew, Persia would probably be near the top of that list of places where you'd probably have a relatively easy life, all things being considered. What we talked about last week was the fact that in such an environment, anti-Semitism can rear its head, and we explored Haman through a very specific lens to kind of understand and grapple with exactly where his anti-Semitism comes from. What I want to do tonight is talk about assimilation and specifically look at Esther, because Esther is fascinating as a character. Hopefully you will all, and as I mentioned last week, and I want to say this again, what I am going to be saying over the next however long is not the definitive way to read Megillat Esther. No. There are multiple lenses, all of them are legitimate. So this is a read that is definitely a legitimate one, that is definitely grasping at part of what the Megillah is trying to express. The Megillah, like any good, well-written work, is expected to be understood on multiple levels. This is just one, but by the end of it, we'll actually see Esther is an atypical biblical character. Esther is a striking character, and what the Megillah seems to suggest about who Esther is and what she becomes is kind of striking. And I actually want to already share the source sheet. And what I actually want to begin with is not from Megillat Esther itself, but actually a quote from the Gemara. It's the Gemara in Sanhedrin. And the Gemara in Sanhedrin is talking about a halachic principle known as Yehoreg V'al Ya'avor, that basically, if someone, classic scenario, which unfortunately in Jewish history was a real scenario, now for us it's a thought experiment, someone puts a gun to your head and says, break halacha, the answer basically is, you break halacha, barring a couple of instances. One is kind of the three cardinal sins, and the other is if they are doing it to intentionally oppress you, or they're doing it to make a public spectacle of your willingness to kind of put aside mitzvot. In those situations, we say, Yehoreg v'al ya'avor, die, don't transgress. And this leads the Gemara to ask a really interesting question about Esther, because we have a problem. V'hi Esther farhesia have. Esther's sin. Esther was willingly and publicly, I shouldn't say willingly, Esther was publicly sleeping with the king. And you don't need to know too much about kind of Jewish law, halacha, to get a sense that that probably is a bad thing. And so the Gemara in Sanhedrin is bothered by this simple fact of Megillat Esther. She's sleeping with a non-Jewish king. And at no point in the story is there any indication whatsoever that that's a problem for Esther. Now, the truth is, that's not the only thing Esther does. Never once, at any point in the Megillah, do we get any problem with observing Shabbat, observing Kashrut, davening, all these sorts of things. And we would expect it, because there are two other well-known biblical stories about biblical figures in exile. The archetype is Yosef in Egypt. And now is not the time to talk about this in detail, but Megillat Esther riffs off that story in many, many different ways. Most famously, the absence of God, which is a drasha for another time that I will give on a Shabbos, please God. But the beginning of the Yosef story has no reference to God either in it. And Megillat Esther riffs off so many words are unique to Esther in the Yosef story. The point is, Yosef is the archetypal biblical figure in exile. And he faces, in one of his most well-known, one of the most well-known scenes, he faces, you know, sexual temptation and overcomes it. He's firm. That's basically the story of Yosef in a nutshell. The other, even more significant example is the book of Daniel, and which isn't just the story of Daniel, it's the story of a whole host of characters, but all of whom are basically, they do the same thing, which is they are exiled, and they are in the palace they are in the palace in Babel. But what we read, Daniel is at pains to tell us they daven, they eat kosher, and despite the fact that they insist on eating this very, what seems an unhealthy diet, they're actually really healthy because of it. The archetypes of figures in exile, says Tanakh, is to be from no matter the cost. And yet we read Megillat Esther and we have huge problems. No references ever made to Esther keeping kosher, Esther keeping Shabbat, Esther davening, a whole host of things. And so there are a few different solutions. One fascinating solution, and so the Essenes, which were a sect that broke away from, and the term mainstream Judaism is terrible because in the Second Temple period, there was no mainstream Judaism. That's why they were having sectarian fights over to decide who would be the mainstream. But the Essenes were a group of people who kind of broke away. They went to live in the middle of nowhere. They are the people from whom we have the Dead Sea Scrolls. And what was very clear was that they lived a very extreme pious life. There is one biblical book we do not have a copy There's two possibilities. One, we've just not found it. But the other possibility, and this is the theory, the Essenes did not copy Esther. They didn't want it because they were religious extremists, for want of a better expression, and they did not like this book, Missing the Name of God, where one of its heroes is sleeping with a king and not really doing much else. They didn't want to hold that person up as a model of religious life, and so they cut it out. One way of dealing with the problem of Esther is just don't read the book. Another way is you reinvent the story. The Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of Tanakh as a whole. I mentioned this last week. The Septuagint version of Esther is fascinating for several reasons. Personally, I think it's most fascinating because it has dragons in it, but I admit that that's a me thing. And more interestingly, it has the name of God inside of it. And not only that, Esther is frummed up. She davens. There's a whole, basically the Septuagint, which was a book written by Jews in exile, a translation made by Jews in exile, facing the same challenges that the book of Esther was facing, and decided to basically rewrite large sections of Megillat Esther. It's fascinating that they did this, and now is not the time to talk about that at length, but Chazal do the same thing. Many of you, I'm sure, have heard the Midrashim about like Esther had seven different handmaids and she cycled them through so that she always knew when Shabbos was and she figured out a way to do kashrut. There are all of these various Midrashic solutions that try to solve some of the major problems with Esther, but there's one you can't escape. She's sleeping with a king. Daniel doesn't sleep with a king. Yosef not sleeping with Paro. So you can circumvent these issues, but Esther is blatantly and obviously the entire story turns on this plot point, which is she lives with the king. And that seems to be a big no-no for a Jew to be doing. And so the Gemara in Sanhedrin, which I show you in source number one, is freaking out about this. And the answer is Amar Abaye Esther Karka Olam Haita. It literally means she was like the ground. In other words, she was entirely passive. It's the Talmudic equivalent of lie back and think of England. But what they try to basically suggest is that Esther didn't want to be there. But it already captures exactly the problem of the book of Esther. And that is, and I hate to use this word, and there are many reasons why I don't want to use this word, but it's a really good word to use to just kind of capture everything I want to say in a nutshell. Esther's not very firm. She's not a religious role model. She's not someone we would point to and be like, here is an example of a religious Jew encountering these challenges, and this is how a religious Jew approaches them. It's the complete opposite. And that's basically what we're going to see tonight. I'm going to walk you through the Megillah highlighting this. And what we're going to see is that Esther does go through a character arc. Megillat Esther is very carefully crafted, but it's also not subtle. Like it's very hits you over the face with stuff. So it's very obvious when she goes through the character arc. But what's more fascinating is when Esther switches, not necessarily in the direction we would think a biblical book would go in. So that's basically what we're going to see over the time, beginning source number two, which is chapter two of Megillat Esther. What I've done is you're kind of looking at a wall of text right now, because I basically just took the relevant verses from the chapters. We're not going to read all of them. This is not like basically Megillah reading over Zoom like a week and 2 days early. But I do want to kind of look at the text as a whole and draw your attention to a few things. So you will see source number two, which is chapter two. Last week, we paid attention to the introduction to Mordechai, which I want to read again. It begins, verse five. Ish Yehudi Hayah B'Shushan HaBirah. There was a Jew. He's known, we talked about this last week, he's blatantly and obviously clearly Jewish. However, that means in Persia, he wears a strimal, whatever, he has his sitting out. Ushma Mordechai, which as I pointed out last week, and I will remind you, not a Jewish name. Mordechai is from Marduk, the chief god of the Persian and Babylonian pantheon. Again, my name is Mark, one of the gospels, one of Jesus's disciples. My Hebrew name is Mordechai, basically same thing in both sides. And we're introduced to Mordechai, fine, Ben Ya'ir, Ben Shim'i, Ben Kish, Ishmini. And then comes the introduction to Esther. So I mentioned last week, the way the Megillah introduces its main characters is key. The way he introduces Ahasuerus sets the context. Mordechai and Haman are basically similarly introduced. Esther is also introduced in an absolutely fascinating way. Vayhi Omein et Hadassah. Mordechai was foster father to a girl called Hadassah. He, Esther, also Esther, bat dodo ki en la av va'en. And basically, you know, and the relationship between her and Mordechai, biologically speaking. The key thing here is, well, what's her name? Her name is Hadassah. That is what her parents called her. But what does she go as? What does she refer to herself as? Esther. Why? So I put a little asterisk because maybe 10 minutes ago I remembered to put this source in. Half an hour ago now. Which is the Gemara. He tries to understand, what does it mean, Hadassah he Esther? What does it mean that they have these two names? Which was her real name? Which was her kind of chosen name? And so Rabbi Nechemia, among many answers, says, Rabbi Nechemia, Aima Hadassah Shmano. Her name was Hadassah. That was what her parents called her. Velama nikrate Esther. So why Esther? Shahayu umot ha'olam korin oto al shum istahar. He takes it in a slightly different direction, but he grasps something which is factually true. Esther is not a Jewish name. It's a Hebrew transliteration of the Persian moon goddess Istar or Istahar. In other words, Esther, like almost all of us, maybe all of us, I'm not going to take a poll, has two names, a Jewish name and a Persian name. Just as I have a Jewish name, Mordechai, and I have an English name, Mark, those are the two names I have. And this is something that's really important to, and it's kind of obvious when you think about it. The names we choose to take for ourselves are tell you everything about someone's identity. And specifically, if you have two names, a Hebrew and an English name, and you are given one but opt to go by the other, it speaks volumes about someone's religiosity. We all know people who are born Marks and then ask at a certain point, can everyone please just start calling me Mordechai? That tends to signal a religious shift. Likewise, there are many people who are born Mordechais, but at a certain point they turn around and say, can everyone please start calling me Mark? And that also speaks volumes to, and I want to be very careful where I'm not saying that is an automatic signal that someone's no longer religious, but it indicates something in their identity. Obviously, if you're in a business context, if you're in a work context, we all know people who go by, you know, multiple names in multiple, you know, venues. But if you consciously choose to go by one name over another, the mere fact that Ruthie and I only gave our children Hebrew names, even though Kayla works very easily as an American name, but Yair and Shai, oh, they don't. But the fact that we didn't even give our kids English names tells you something about our identity and how kind of we view things. So the fact is, and this is already crucial, Hadassah does not go by Hadassah. She does not want to be called Hadassah. That's not what she wants to be known as. The entire time she goes as Esther. In other words, we had Mordechai, who was given a blatantly Persian name, and is nonetheless unambiguously an Ish Yehudi. He is a Jew. Hadassah, the Megillah introduces us with this overt Hadassah. You don't get more Jewish a name than Hadassah. Like it's from the Torah, you know, like Hadass. But she chooses to go by a Persian name. She's the opposite of Mordechai. Mordechai is an Ish Yehudi with a non-Jewish name. And Esther or Hadassah is a Persian woman using her Persian name. What the Megillah also tells us here is that she's incredibly good looking, which is obviously important for the plot point that's going to happen. What we then read, and we're not going to read it inside, but we have the king's proclamation to assemble all the girls. It's very cute that we teach kids it's a beauty contest, but like the Megillah itself could not be more explicit about what's actually going on here. And we are told that Esther, here, I just highlighted in the Hebrew, Vatilakach Esther al Beit HaMelech, Esther 2, was taken into the king's palace. El Yad Hegai Shomer Hanashim, under the supervision of Hegai, the guardian of the women. We are also told something fascinating. Verse 10. Lo higida Esther et Amma ve'et Molatta. Esther did not reveal her people or her kindred. Ki Mordechai tziva aleha asher lo tagid. Mordechai had told her not to. So even though we spoke last week, and again, I was careful not to try and paint too idyllic a portrait of Persia, and we explored the fact that anti-Semitism clearly exists in Persia, Mordechai, who works in the palace, clearly knows maybe there's more anti-Semitism, maybe there's more whatever than one might think. So he, you know, as someone who knows the inner workings of the palace, is like, don't reveal your Jewishness, just kind of, you know, make sure everyone knows, you know, thinks you're just Persian and that's it. And then we read example of how the Megillah just doesn't even make it subtle. But erev hi ba'a, in each and every case, a woman would go at nighttime, uvaboka hi shava, she would return in the morning, el beit hanashim sheni, to the second harem. So, in other words, the women who lose the beauty contest never actually leave the palace. El yad sha'ashgaz, suris hamelech shomeha pilagshim, and they're now under the care of sha'ashgaz, who's the chief of the concubines, and basically the king can still call them. Rav Soloveitchik, by the way, has an absolutely brilliant point here, which is the Megillah, which is so careful with its words, spends so many words describing the excesses of the Persian palace, both in chapter 1 and chapter 2, to give you a sense of kind of the hedonism of Persia and to paint really clearly a portrait of the kind of person Ahasuerus is, and the kind of person, you know, he's not a good guy. And this is not, you know, having concubines is kind of typical kingly behavior, but nonetheless, the Megillah really wants you to understand the kind of the environment that Persia was, the world in which Persia was. And we read at the end, verse 16. Vatilakoch Esther el Hamelech Achashverosh el Beit Malchuto. Esther's summoned Bachodesh Ha'asirihu Chodesh Tevet. We learn the month. Reminder that the months we use for Hebrew are actually the Babylonian names. So Tevet would have been what the Persians called it too. Bishnat Shevala Malchuto. So there's been a period of time she's been kind of around here. And we learn Vayehav Hamelech et Esther Mikol Hanashim. She's his choice. She wins. He loves her more than anyone. Vatizochen v'chesed lefanav Mikol Abtulot. He loves her more than all the rest. Vayosin Keta Malchut Barasho Vayamnicheha Tachad Vashti. And that's where the chapter ends. That's a lie. It doesn't end there, but that's where this part of the story ends. She becomes queen. So we have Esther in the palace, hiding her identity, but we also have already seen, the Megillah already clued us into the fact that it's not like, you know, she was walking around asking to be called Hadassah, you know, that kind of thing. Like, she's very clearly and obviously Esther with her Persian name, and now she's been thrust. This is an obvious plot point, but it's worth noting. She's been thrust into this potential position of power, which is obviously going to be crucial because chapter 3 is Haman. And I mentioned Esther and Haman basically phase out in their chapters until they come together. And then Haman's dead, so he doesn't really get any more chapters. But it's chapter 3 is Haman. Haman versus Mordechai. Chapter 2 is Mordechai and Esther. Chapter 3 is Haman and Mordechai. And that leads us on to chapter 4. And this is after Haman has decreed, we're going to kill all the Jews. And this is chapter 4 is already where the character development of Esther turns, and a sensitive and close reading of the words used in the Megillah here reveal a lot of depth. So first we read, Mordechai yada et kol asher na'asa. Mordechai learned all that had happened. Haman wants to kill the Jews. Vayikra Mordechai begadav, vayilbash sak va'efer. He tears his clothes, he puts on sackcloth and ashes. Something really important to note, we're going to see it already here in other locations too. Clothing is a major theme of Megillat Esther. Also a major theme of the story of Yosef, in a lot of obvious ways, but also a lot of subtle ways. All the major plot points of Yosef's life hinge on clothing. Also the Book of Esther. Mordechai changes into sackcloth and ashes here. Obviously, the most famous point is when Mordechai is dressed as the king. Haman wants to dress as the king. Mordechai is dressed as the king. But there are a lot of other cloth significances that we are going to read. The point is Mordechai is crying and mourning at this point because having learned, the Jews are all going to be killed basically a year from then. Vayavo ad lifnei sha'ar ha-melech, he can't actually go to work at that point. It seems like he would basically hang around near work in his kind of, you know, he's not actually going to because he can't be. The key thing is verse number 3, in all the places the king's law had reached, Evel Gadol, I put it in purple, Evel Gadol la Yehudim, there was great mourning among the Jews, the Tzom v'chi u'mispeit. Sack va'efer yutzalaram, everyone starts wearing sackcloth and ashes. This is important. Mordechai and all the Jews are all now already in a national state, visible state of mourning. Next we read, verse 4. Vatavona na'arot Esther v'sariseha v'yagidula. Esther's maidens and eunuchs come and they inform her of what all the Jews are doing. It's unclear whether these people know she's Jewish or just they. It seems impossible from the plot point that some people don't know her secret identity in the palace, those close to her. But either way, they let her know, by the way, have you seen what's kind of happening with all the Jews? They're doing something kind of strange. They're wearing sackcloth and ashes and crying everywhere. We just said we were going to exterminate them. Not sure what all the fuss is about. But anyway, they tell Esther what's going on. Vatitchalchal hamalka ma'od. The queen, note she's referred to here as the queen. She's really agitated. She's really upset. Now we think, well, what's she upset about? Oh, they're going to kill the Jews. Vatishlach begadim lahalbish et Mordechai. Ulahasir sako me'alav v'lo kibel. She sends him a change of clothes. In other words, and as we're going to see, very obvious, she's not got the point here. What she just thinks is Mordechai's dressed strangely. He needs to change. He's making a scene. We don't want him to make a scene. He's embarrassing himself. She sends clothes to him to change. That what's agitating her is the fact that Mordechai is wearing sackcloth and ashes. Vatikra Esther lahatach, verse 5, Misarisei HaMelech Asher HaEmid Lefanai. She summons Hatach, who we're assuming is one of her advisors closest to her, one of the eunuchs. Vatzavehu al Mordechai ladat mazeh va'al mazeh, to find out what's going on. In other words, she's not at this point figured out why Mordechai is wearing sackcloth and ashes. She has not learned, she has not been told, it has not been revealed to her this mass extermination plan at this point. What she initially reacted to, what caused the queen Vatitchalchal to be so agitated, was simply the realization that her uncle is making kind of a fool of himself, a spectacle of himself. And basically, I skipped the verses where Hatach goes and talks to Mordechai. Verse 9. Vayavo Hatach vayoged laEsther et divrei Mordechai. So he comes back and delivers Mordechai's message. Mordechai's message is, Esther, you're the queen. You've got to go and save the Jews. Her reaction is astounding. Vatoma Esther lehatach vatzavehu al Mordechai. Take the following reply to Mordechai. Kol avdei hamelech va'am medinot hamelech yode'im. Everyone knows, and all the people of Persia, all the people of the king's provinces, know asher kol ish v'isha sheyavor hamelech el chatera pnimit. If you go there and you've not been summoned, you'll be put to death. Only if the king sends out his scepter can you be received. In other words, her instinct is to think, okay, she wants to protect her life, but her instinct is, I must follow Persian custom. I must follow, her identity is wrapped up in this sense of Persian protocol. And most interesting is this word am here. The word nation. Esther uses the term Am, which means nation, people, to refer to Am Medinot HaMelech, the people of Persia. That's what she sees as the Am. That's the word, the key word to refer to peoplehood. She ascribes to the people of Persia. And then Mordechai says the following. And it's verse 13. Vayomer Mordechai lachoshiv el Esther. He had the following message said. Al tadmi benafsheich. Lehimolet beit hamelech mikol hayehudim. Don't forget, Esther, you're a Jew. You're not going to be saved. Because ultimately they'll realize, they'll figure out that you're a Jew. Mordechai reminds her, Mordechai basically like, look, can you do us a favor? Spare our lives, approach the king. And she's like, sorry, I can't. And like, admittedly, you know, Ruthie will tell you, I am someone whose first reaction is usually to be like, I don't think that's possible. You know, my first reaction is to think of all the possible things that can go wrong. It tells you a lot about a person when they react that way. But the fact that her instinct is to think, all the things that can go wrong are about Persian law. Her first thought is not, the Megillah doesn't tell us like she's really stressed about this. Oh my goodness, I've got to figure out a way. Okay, Mordechai, give me a couple of days to figure out a plan. Her first reaction is, every Persian knows I can't do this. In other words, Mordechai, you don't realize Persians can't do this. I'm the Persian queen. What can I do? To which Mordechai responds, you may be the Persian queen, but you are also a Jew and you will be killed too. Ki im hacharesh tacharishi ve. Keep quiet. And this is like a celebrated verse from Esther, from the Megillah. And that's a really powerful verse, but there's a really cool part within it that we tend to, that's the one bit we skate over. Revach v'hatzala ya'amod la'yehudim mimakom acher. Salvation will come to the Jews from another corner. Mordechai is like, look, God's going to save us. He doesn't use the term God because it's Megillah Esther. We're going to be delivered. Va'at uveit avicha tovedu. But you and your father's house will be wiped out. And then comes the famous line, perhaps you got to this place, you know, purely for this reason. But the actual key line here is what Mordechai says. Mordechai's like, Esther, if you don't save us, we'll be fine. But at you uveit avicha and your father's house will perish. What Mordechai reminds Esther about is her not national Jewish religious identity, but simply her familial one. She has a responsibility as the daughter of Avichael. She has a responsibility as his daughter to basically, you know, perpetuate that line, continue that line, keep that going. There is a sense here, and this is where it's so fascinating when we think of the relevance of Megillat Esther of Jews in exile, and we think of the different ways Jews around us construct their identity. Not all Jews construct their identity in religious means. Some of them construct their identity solely in family means. You have a responsibility to your parents, to your grandparents who came over from Poland or wherever. That's basically Mordechai's guilt trip here. At uveit avicha, your father's house will perish. No one will ever remember your family's line if you disappear. That is the point that Mordechai makes. He tries to appeal to her as a Yehudi, fails. So then he tries to appeal to her as the daughter of her father. And what happens? Vatoma Esther lahashiv al Mordechai. She sends back the following: Lech knos et kol hayehudim hanimtzoim b'Shushan. Gather all the Jews. V'tzumu elai v'al tochlu v'al tishtu shloshet yamim laila v'yom, 3-day fast. Gam ani v'narotai atzum kein, and I will join it too. This is again, it's not subtle, and it happens very quickly. But this is where Esther turns the corner. This is where she goes from being Esther the Persian into Esther, the person who realizes and recognizes her identity as a Jew. But what's amazing is what she is how the Megillah plays this out. Again, it's important to realize, and I hopefully pointed this out last week, I honestly can't remember, Mordechai throughout is continuously referred to as Mordechai HaYehudi. We'll see this again tonight, so even if we didn't last week, we'll see it in the same sources. Mordechai's Jewishness remains consistent throughout. Mordechai is an unexciting character. He doesn't go through an arc. He's Mordechai Yehudi at the beginning. He gets into all of this trouble for being a Jew in the middle, and then he's Mordechai Yehudi at the end. What would we expect a good biblical book to do at this point? We have Esther, who's Hadassah, but she goes as Esther. And now she's finally realized her religious identity, her Jewish identity, and she's done this fast. We would probably expect the Megillah to now reveal Hadassah HaYehudi. If that's, Yehudi might not be the correct conjugation for a female. But anyway, Hadassah the Jewess. Nope. The Megillah does the absolute opposite. Ah, Brenda asks a question. She's the last of her parents' house. So she is. What's kind of interesting here is, surely Mordechai is also part of her Beit Avicha. Mordechai is also part of her house, which could also just simply imply that Mordechai, for whatever reason or another, has no descendants, and Esther's the last chance at the entire family to kind of have a future. But yeah, she's basically the last of the family line. That is, again, and I'm sure there's a lot more to explore about that. Which is a really interesting thing to realize, because it's a point made by the Megillah again pretty explicitly, but we just kind of skate over it. But there is this dimension here of Esther being the last in the family line, who also is now a Persian queen, and the whole question of who her children were, and Chazal talk about this, and all that sort of stuff. But what we would expect the next bits to be are Esther embracing her Jewish identity. But she doesn't. She does the opposite. Chapter 5. Vayihi bayoyim hashlishi. What happens on the third day after the fast? Remember, clothing is significant. Vatilbash Esther malchut. She wears her royal apparel. Vata'amod b'chatzar beit hamelech hapimit nochach beit hamelech. She comes to the king's court. Remember, she's risking her life here. V'hamelech yoshev al kisei malchuto b'veit hamalchut nochach petach habayit. He's standing facing her. And then we get Vayehi Chirat HaMelech, when the king sees, not Hadassah the Jew, Esther HaMalka, Queen Esther. Omedet b'chatzar nasa achein be'enav, and then he lends out his golden scepter, boom. Esther's turn, saving the Jews, is actually by embracing her Persian identity. She's no longer Hadassah he Esther. She's now Esther Hamalka. She gets an almost name change. And she's frequently, not entirely, but she's frequently, and we will see other examples of this, referred to explicitly as Esther Hamalka, Esther the Queen, at pivotal plot points at this point. She wears, and again, clothing is significant, especially when we're leaning into the Yosef story, and his transformations also happen with clothes changes. She wraps herself in the clothing of Persia, which we also talked about this last week with Haman, has tremendous levels of symbolism in terms of identity. She embraces her identity as Queen Esther. And this all comes to the ultimate, you know, togetherness when in chapter 7 of Megillat Esther, she reveals to Ahasuerus who she is and why Haman's plot is actually a problem for Ahasuerus. Because ultimately, the entire plot hinges on not Ahasuerus's turn that he suddenly wants to, you know, save all the Jews, but we've already learned, by the way, this is a complete aside, we've already learned how seriously Ahasuerus takes Persian law. And so he realizes he doesn't want to kill Esther, so he's going to have to fix things somehow. But how does this all happen? Source 5, which is chapter 7. Vaton Esther Hamalka Vatoimar. Queen Esther responded, Im Matsati Chain Beinecha HaMelech, if I find favor in the king's eyes, V'im Al HaMelech Tov, and if it's good for you, Tinoten Li Nafshi Bish'elati Va'ami Ba'Bakashati. Grant me and my people my life. Ki Nimkarnu Ani Va'Ami, for me and my people. Lahashmid, Laharog, Ul Abed, to be destroyed, massacred, exterminated. And then she says, like, even if we were just going to be slaves, it would have been cool. It wouldn't be worth it for you. But the particular issue is the destruction and the death. Within the spaces of two verses, we get something really striking. We have Esther Hamalka, Queen Esther, but also a reference to Ami as the Jewish people. She recognizes her identity as a Jew and a Persian queen, but it's the complete opposite direction to Mordechai. Mordechai is a Jew who happens to be able to take on all these other roles. Esther is the queen of Persia, who happens to also relate to her Jewishness. And this is really fascinating because Rav Aaron Lichtenstein never talked about it in the context of Megillat Esther. But he talks about in other contexts, kind of different levels of identification as a Jew. And what he points out is that, and it was actually, there was a famous case in Israel many, many, many years ago, Brother Daniel, which was a Catholic priest who now wanted to go back to Israel on the right of return. And the question basically was, you know, could he be considered for the right of return? So Rav Lichtenstein opposed his Brother Daniel's right to go to Israel. And his point was, it's one thing to reject Jewish religion. Fine. That is, it is what it is. Lots of people do it. But it's another thing to reject identification as part of what he called Knesset Yisrael, which is the congregation of Jewish people. It's one thing to see yourself as Queen Esther, who, again, the Megillah makes them, that if we take the Megillah at face value, and I would encourage you to do on at least some levels, Esther has no qualms with keeping with the fact that she's not keeping kosher. She has no qualms with whatever she does. She has no qualms with the fact that she's living with the king. Remember, the story ends and they lived happily ever after. You know, she ends still being the queen. The point is, though, she nonetheless identifies herself as a member of the Jewish people. And it's that identification, says the book of Esther, which ultimately marks her as someone able to save the people. And it makes chapter 9, which I've put as source 6, absolutely fascinating. Because we read the laws of Purim, and we don't really pay attention to the way different people are described at this point, because it's the end of the Megillah and we all want to go home. But this is where the Megillah really throws it in our faces. Vatichtov Esther Hamalka. Thus wrote Queen Esther, Bat Avichail, the daughter of Avichail. In other words, she has her two identities are wrapped up in this phrase, contrasted, by the way, with Mordechai HaYehudi, Mordechai the Jew. We have Queen Esther, the daughter of Avichail, and we also have Mordechai the Jew. And this is very, very significant in how it frames their identities. Mordechai is always the same identity. He's Jewish. Esther is not, she's obviously Jewish, but she's not explicitly called out as being Jewish. We don't reference, once again, we get a reference to Avichail, which last time we got the reference was also in connection to her, you know, but no reference to Hadassah. She's purely Esther Hamalka at this point, but nonetheless, she retains that identification with Knesset Yisrael. Mordechai HaYehudi retains that more expansive and obvious connection with Judaism. He's a Jew. Esther's a queen, but she's also the daughter of a Jew. She has that Jewish connection. She recognizes, ultimately, that she has that Jewish relationship within him. But it's both of them who come together. Lekayemet Igeret HaPurim Hazat HaSheinit. They create Purim together. And we read, Lekayem et Yemei HaPurim Ha'ila Bizmanehem, Kasher Kiyam Aleihem Mordechai HaYehudi VeEsther HaMalka. Purim is created by both Mordechai and Esther. And these verses are halachic in nature. This is where the Gemara and Megillah attaches so much significance to the verses of chapter 9. You read the Gemara and Megillah, and it's like, starts off the whole thing just obsessing over the second half of the ninth chapter of the Megillah, which the rest of us all just our eyes glaze over during it. But oh, this teaches us this halacha, this teaches us this halacha. All of those halachot are not just the writing of Mordechai HaYehudi, but Esther HaMalka. And that's what makes and just finally that Uma Amar Esther Kiyam Divrei HaPurim HaEla VaNichtav BaSefer. And it's Esther ultimately who's responsible for the holiday of Purim. And so what Megillat Esther does is something that I think is fascinating because it's unusual. The other situations in which we have, and I'm going to stop the screen share so you're all about to see my face much bigger. What Megillat Esther does is not reveal Esther as a character like Daniel and all the other characters in Daniel, not like Yosef, who are blatantly and explicitly religious Jews. And at all points in the story, basically it exists to let us know that. We do have in Megillat Esther an example of such a character, Mordechai. He refuses to bow down to Haman for unclear but obviously religious reasons. We saw that last week. It's very obvious. The psukim make it pretty clear. But what it also gives us is a completely different character, which is Esther, who has chosen to, if not reject, that is wrong, but she has chosen to emphasize her Persian identity over her Jewish one and has no qualms, much to, you know, rabbinic confusion, you know, to this very day. She has no qualms, says the literal text of the book, with any of these, you know, religious rules everyone else we would expect to observe. She has no qualms with anything like that. And the way she saves the Jewish people is through embracing that Persian identity and by identifying with the Jewish people on perhaps one of the slimmest of levels, simply that she's Bat Avichayim. Ultimately, that's what brings her to do everything. This realization of Beit Avicha, of her, you know, responsibility as a child of her parents, it's that most tenuous of connections that ultimately leads her to do what she does. But, you know, she's not ever doing it by truly embracing her Jewish identity. In fact, the opposite. And that's what makes Megillat Esther so fascinating. And it's the only biblical book that captures this kind of world, because it's the only biblical book that speaks to this kind of, that speaks to this world. A world in which Jews are living in relative tolerance, who have choices to, you know, reject aspects of their identity and pick up other aspects of their identity and can live, you know, legitimate lives with a piecemeal approach to their Judaism. In times of oppression, you can't do this. You know, the emancipation brought with it so much secularism because Jews for the first time were allowed to not be religious. It's not like every Jew in the shtetl was a pious chassid who like learned Torah like 14 hours a day and spent the rest of the time saying Tehillim when he wasn't sleeping. No, but you didn't have any other choice. But once you could finally move to the big city, you suddenly faces these choices of identity. But Megillat Esther is the only book in Tanakh that speaks to those same challenges and challenges we all face today and challenges the wider Jewish community faces. How do we construct our identity? If you construct your identity solely in the realm of Torah and mitzvot, that obviously has a smaller catchment area. If you throw, you know, the net of identity over people who see themselves as part of the Jewish people, it's far wider. And if you throw the net of you have, you know, a Jewish parent, you have Jewish parents, and that gives you some sort of connection to the Jewish world, that makes an even wider catchment. And it's fascinating that we have a book in Tanakh that seems to validate that approach, that seems to show a way in which such a perspective on identity can lead, obviously, to the safety and security of the Jewish people. We're going to see next week perhaps it goes even more extreme with this, but part of Megillat Esther is look at the people who save the Jews and kind of look at the people who get into trouble. Like Mordechai at the end of the day, and he's clearly not ever looked at negatively in the Megillah, chas v'shalom. But the point is, it's his religiosity that gets the Jews in trouble. And it's specifically Esther's irreligiosity that saves them. Mordechai was so religious, he refuses to bow to Haman. Unfortunately, his niece is cool with doing a lot of stuff, you know, we wouldn't expect, you know, biblical heroes to be cool doing in order to save anyone and embracing that identity. And so, obviously, I should make clear, the message of Megillat Esther is not, you know what, if you want to be a Mordechai, great, and if you want to be an Esther, go on, you can do that too. That would be a bad message to advocate. But what it's saying is we have to recognize and we have to realize that ultimately people who identify themselves as Jews and people who cast their lot in with the Jewish people are crucial components of our own safety and security in exile. And that ultimately it doesn't matter how from a Jew is. It doesn't matter how strongly that Jew sees themselves as a Jew versus American. It doesn't matter to a certain extent, as long as they're not a self-hating Jew. It doesn't matter how much that Jew seems to lean so little into their Jewishness. The mere fact that they have some semblance of Jewish connection can end up saving the lives of Jews. And obviously, in a story like Megillat Esther, where the most overarching message is God isn't mentioned, because they kind of have to do all of this stuff themselves and hope that God helps them, which is the undercurrent of the story, that is our world. We don't live in a biblical world where God is constantly raining down, you know, lightning bolts, shooting it at all our enemies, and performing overt miracles. We live in the world of Megillat Esther, where the best we can hope for are people sympathetic to the Jewish cause and people sympathetic to their Jewish identities. And so Megillat Esther basically reveals that notion to be a core one in Jewish survival and validates not go out there and be an Esther, but validates don't dismiss the Esthers of this world. Don't just turn around and look at the Esthers and be like, ah, they may identify as a Jew, but you know what? They're not Jewish enough for me, because ultimately, you don't know how helpful the slimmest of Jewish identities, va'at u'beit avicha toved, va'at u'beit avich tovedu. You don't know how little that identity thread might be that could end up saving the Jewish people. And that is what makes Esther such a fascinating character. That's what makes Megillat Esther so fascinating in it's the one biblical book that provides a hero who's not from, which is crazy. The whole point of the Torah, we think, is to give us models of religiosity. And yet one of its last books is actually the complete antithesis. And what we're going to talk about next week is perhaps even crazier. And that is what Megillat Esther has to say about what it means to be a Jew living outside of the land of Israel when there are Jews living inside the land of Israel. And what we're going to see is that the Megillah does not lean into this idea. I've got to stop using that phrase. I don't know why I started using it a lot, but the Megillah lean in. The Megillah does not talk about this at length, but it is actually a very subtle undercurrent to the entire Megillah is this question of Jews in Shushan versus Jews in other parts of the Persian Empire, most notably in the land of Israel. And that is something we will talk about next week, which will be 2 days before Purim.